Hey, Media People podcast listeners, if you enjoy the podcast, then you're going to love our newsletter, appropriately named the Media People Newsletter. Delivered right to your inbox, each edition is a mix of original and curated content designed to feed your curiosity while aiding in personal development. On top of more podcasts, we'll connect you with articles, interviews, and industry events. Subscribe at mediapeople.ca/newsletter or go to mediapeople.behive.com. That's B-E-E-H-I-I-V. Thanks for listening to the Media People Podcast, lively and insightful chats with the people who power the media industry. I'm your host, Victor Genova. For more episodes, you can go to mediapeople.ca or subscribe wherever you get podcasts, including youtube.com/@mediapeoplepodcast. Views expressed by participants are personal. Kensington Gray is an influencer management agency rooted in diversity, representing an extensive roster of black and brown creators. At the heart of the agency is President and CEO Shanae Ingleton-Smith. Born in Toronto, but raised in Calgary, Shanae studied finance and economics in university, but marketing was her real passion. There wasn't an option to major in it, so Shanae filled her electives with every marketing class available. She moved into finance after graduation, but quickly pivoted into media sales with Media Planet Publishing. Shanae moved to Rogers Media, holding sales roles at Maclean's Magazine, Elevate Multi-Platform Sales, and leading a multi-million dollar territory of education-based clients. It was during this time that the seeds for Kensington Gray were planted. Shanae ran a private Facebook group providing business advice to black influencers. She noticed that their opportunities were slim and that their services were undervalued. Shanae saw a chance to rectify this, and Kensington Gray was born.
Kensington Gray Agency is an influencer management firm that focuses on representing Black and Brown creators. We represent some of the most powerful Black voices in the space, and it's a labor of love. I, as the CEO, am responsible for strategy, for ensuring that we remain profitable, for connecting us with strategic partners, execution, and just overall making sure that our team is where we need to be and we're hiring the right people and moving the company forward in the right direction.
Shanae, thank you so much for stopping by. I know we've been trying to get this on the books for a while now, but you've had a very busy schedule. So thanks for carving some time out today. But as always, we go back to the beginning. Where are you from?
So I was born in Toronto. I was raised in Calgary, Alberta. I moved there before my first birthday. And I moved back to Toronto to go to U of T actually and study commerce there when I was an adult. So
your entire childhood was in Calgary?
Yes.
What was life like growing up in Calgary?
I had fond memories of, you know, my childhood, but I was definitely, you know, we were the only Black family, and Calgary wasn't very diverse. It's a lot more diverse now, but still has a long way to go for sure. But yeah, we were one of the only Black families. I was, you know, typically one of the only Black kids in my class, but it forced me to have to, you know, connect with people that were different than me and to be in situations where you were like the other person. And it helped me start feeling comfortable in those positions or more comfortable, you know, than I would be had I been thrown into those things as an adult.
And for the early part of your childhood, you said you were starting a new school every year up until about the fifth grade. Have I got that right?
Well, we moved into a new house every year up until like the fifth grade. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. But it was the same school though?
It was the same school until the fifth grade. And then I started a new school in the fifth grade. So we did move a lot. I grew up in like a single parent household. And, you know, we moved based on, you know, what we could afford. And, but one of the things my mom always tried to do was to ensure that we, you know, didn't have to change schools. And fortunately with Calgary being smaller at the time, even though we moved, we stayed at the same schools for the most part.
How did that impact you as a fifth grader? Because at that point you were probably what, 11 years old, I'd say?
Yeah,
and
I was
just kind of 10 years old. Okay. So just kind of like hitting the reboot button on, I guess, your social life and your academic life.
I was actually very excited. It's so weird because I remember vividly the night before the first day of school in fifth grade. So I do remember it being like a huge moment, but I was like super excited about like all the friends that I was going to make. I was like excited about like what the school was going to be like. And it was exciting, actually.
You are going to be episode 90. Yeah, this is episode 95 that we're recording right now. And I always ask my guests what their interests or hobbies are. You were the first person to come up and say it was track and field. How did you discover track and field in school?
My neighbor, so the house that we moved into when I was, that's when I was in the fifth grade, our neighbor, like adjacent to us, behind us, was a track and field coach, and his daughter became my best friend. So we played with each other like literally every day. And he started taking us to track practice, and I was just really into it. And it stuck with me until I graduated high school.
What attracted you to long jump and the hurdles, though, out of all the events you could have picked?
So when I started my first ever track meet, they made us do everything. So I had to do the 800, I had to do shot put, I had to do high jump, I had to do long jump, I had to do hurdles. They basically made us do everything. And the two things that I did really well at were long jump, high jump, and the hurdles. So so I kind of just like stuck to that. And then eventually over time, I started doing combined events. So like the pentathlon and the heptathlon.
And you had an offer to go to the United States on a athletic scholarship. Have I got that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So how does that work? Like, do you know that you're being scouted, or does just one day someone come up to you at track practice and say, hey, I'm so-and-so with this university or college in the United States. I want to talk more about your future with us.
So there's actually rules about scouting. Like there's actual like college scouts, like where their job is to like find potential talent at track meets. So that is what happened. I think that you like there's a certain age that you I think you have to be like 15 or 16 or something like that. You can't be scouted before a certain age. They're NCAA rules, but I was at a track meet in the US. So I was good enough that I was competing in the US. So there was a big track meet in Oregon. And I believe it was like, I think it's called the Prefontaine Classic. So, you know, Prefontaine, the guy who, he was like a famous runner in Oregon. And I was at that track meet and I was scouted by a college track and field scout.
But you turned down the opportunity.
I turned down the opportunity because I was actually a really good student, and it was very important to me that if I did go away for track and field, that it would be to a school that had like a high standing academically, and this school was like had like an okay track team, but like a subpar academic program for what I wanted to study, which was business. So it was just like, I can't. So I just made the decision. And I had friends that were like really like super high performing, and actually some of them ended up going on to be in the Olympics. So I was happy to like kind of root for them from afar. So some of them ended up going to like the University of Texas at Austin to become a Longhorn, and went to some of like the other really amazing track and field schools like Rice or LSU. But my offer just wasn't up to par. So I was like, you know, I'm going to focus on academics, and I got actually enough academic scholarships to cover like my first few years at university.
Why do you credit your parents as being your role models?
Because I learned everything that I know, or so much of what I know now is like as an entrepreneur, from watching them be entrepreneurs, from watching them face adversity. Both of my parents were entrepreneurs. My dad was an entrepreneur as well, and he had like a side hustle. So he studied architecture and civil engineering. And my mom, she she had a famous, or not famous, but I guess like one of the few Jamaican restaurants in Calgary. And I just saw them like, you know, have ideas and like bring them to life. So for me, that was normal. for like you to be sitting at the dinner table and be like, I want to like start a business and like start throwing events. And in my dad's case, it was like, I want to start bringing like, you know, acts from the Caribbean to Canada so they can perform at like Carabana. So he brought like Shaggy, or he would bring like just different like popular reggae artists to Toronto. And this is like pre-internet, pre even like email or anything. And like he found a way to connect with these artists and like, bring them from these other countries to Toronto, which at the time was kind of like, you know, unheard of. Unless you were like with a record label or you were, you know, somebody who had those types of connections. He was just like an architect who had a love for music, and he just made it happen. And then my mom, who worked in like the insurance industry for many years, she decided one day to acquire or to buy a Jamaican food grocery store retail space from somebody that she knew. And then she turned it into like a restaurant / grocer for the Jamaican community in Calgary. And her only background prior to that was, you know, working as an insurance professional. But that was like a normal thing for me. This is that people around me and people in my family would start up businesses or create opportunities for themselves when they grew tired of, you know, the corporate, I guess, rat race, if you will.
Nice segue into my next question, because your first job was a babysitter. Like, there is no better freelance job for an 11-year-old than that.
Yeah. I babysat all the kids in my neighborhood. Yeah.
But you credit your first real job, I guess the one where you have to pay taxes on it, as working in a local grocery store. So what did you learn about yourself between those two jobs, babysitting and working in the grocery store? Because here you've kind of got like a very, 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 very small taste of entrepreneurship. But then on the flip side, you've also got a taste of working for someone else.
I realized, and actually, let me segue. So I had my first job was at a grocery store, and I used to like bring the groceries out to like people's cars. But my second job right after that, I worked at the airport, but it was for a Black-owned business called Airport Direct. And it was two brothers that would drive a shuttle from the airport to people's homes, which was like a new concept. And the reason why I bring up those two jobs is because what I learned about myself, I learned two things. One, that I didn't really particularly like working for other people, for one, and like following like the rules and like the confinement of being in like kind of like a corporate structure. But I found that I enjoyed working for people that I could relate to and that like saw me as their equal a lot more than I did when I worked for people who didn't. And that was like, there was a stark difference between me working in that job as a grocery clerk to me working as like a front desk clerk at the airport. Because my bosses looked like me, and like the rest of people, other people on the team also looked like me. And I didn't realize that, I think, until I was much older now, because I have a similar setup at the, you know, that we've created at Kensington Gray.
You also worked for your mom doing telemarketing calls. Was this your first taste of sales?
It sure was. Yeah. She had like a telemarketing side hustle thing. And there was like these long sheets of paper with phone numbers. And then she would give them to my sister and I. So she would do calls, and then my sister and I would have to do calls as well. And she would like give us like $20 or whatever. And I remember like banging through like all the phone numbers and calling people and have them like hang up on us and stuff like that. But then some people would actually like hear me out. But what it did for me was like, it eliminated like fear. I wasn't afraid to call anybody. I wasn't afraid of what I would receive or hear on the other end of the line. And I found it to be fun. And like, to me back then, like $20 was a lot of money. So it was worth it.
So it was like a commission job then for like everything. Yes. It closed $20. There was, yes, your first taste of sales. I mean, you eat, yeah, what you kill.
Yes.
So why the University of Toronto? Like, why relocate from Calgary back to Toronto? And why did you study commerce?
So commerce was just that was a no-brainer for me. Like, I just, there was no other option. Like, I knew I wasn't going to do like psychology or the sciences or anything like that. I think that like my dad always said that you should study business. I just, for me, it just, there was just no other option for me. The reason why I went to University of Toronto is because I was like, I've lived in Calgary my whole life. I've visited Toronto growing up as a kid because that's where a lot of my family was. So I had a taste of like the big city, and I always knew deep down inside that I was a big city girl at heart and I needed to move to the big city. And then I moved to Toronto. And then there was a point in my 20s, like after graduating from university, I was like, I'm going to move to New York. Like I should be in New York. Like that's just like where like I belong. But then like life like started lifing and I realized, okay, you know what, I can't afford New York rent. But you know, funny enough, New York is my second home, and we're actually, we've considered either buying property in New York because we are there so often, or renting or leasing like a loft or something. So we have somewhere to stay when we go, because I'm there 3 or 4 times a month.
Your passion was marketing, but there was no option to major in marketing at the University of Toronto. So was it finance and economics? That's what you studied, and you filled your academic time with as many marketing electives as possible.
Yes. Yeah. So everyone at the University of Toronto Rotman School of Business graduates with a BCom in finance with a specialist in economics. So there's no option to like deter from that. But yeah, all of my electives were in marketing. And, you know, at the time that was just such a drag. I felt like that we had to do all these like finance and economics courses. However, in hindsight, I think that it was smart that making everyone graduate with that specialization. Because I think that if you understand finance and economics, then you can do all of the other things too. So whereas if you just graduate with like a degree in marketing, you know, it might be tough to like go into like finance or accounting or something like that. So I had like many options when it came time to graduate of different areas that I could go into because of where I specialize. But I knew like without hesitation immediately that marketing and PR and that's all that sort of thing stuff was like where I would end up.
Did you have any family in Toronto when you landed to start university, or was everyone still back in Calgary?
Yeah. So my parents actually divorced when I was younger. So we moved to Calgary, and then my parents divorced, and then my dad actually moved back to Toronto. So I spent my summers in Toronto growing up. So I was very familiar with Toronto, and a lot of his side of the family lived in Toronto as well. So I did know people in Toronto. And then Toronto is just kind of one of those places where everyone knows somebody there. And I was at that age where a lot of my friends were moving out of their houses, like moving, you know, away for either school or just moving out of the house because they were now adults. So I had a few friends that had moved to Toronto too.
After graduation, you didn't jump right into marketing though. You actually pursued finance. So tell me about what you did at Mannion Wilkins and Associates, because you were a client representative there.
Yeah. So Mannion Wilkins is a benefit consulting firm that basically would go into companies and evaluate their benefits programs and see where they could like save money or where there's cost efficiencies. So if it means maybe you, as opposed to like the company approving the name brand drugs, do you, you know, change the program so that they start only approving the generic drug and save money that way, or removing things like orthodontia from your dental plan so that you're not like paying for like the whole company to have braces. So things like that we would look at to just like, we would see like the actual patterns of use within a corporation. And then we would make recommendations on how they could update their benefit plan to better or more efficiently serve the actual use, and then remove the things that people aren't using. Or in some cases, depending on whoever was in charge, we would eliminate the things that people were using too much and costing the company way too much money.
You almost sound like an investment banker in some ways, because you go in, you evaluate the company from top to bottom, you take away parts that are inefficient, and then you kind of repackage it. Although you guys aren't you guys aren't planning on reselling the company the way investment bankers are, but kind of that's what was going through my mind as you were explaining it to me.
Yeah, very, very similar. That's definitely, it's a huge expense for a lot of companies. And then there's other elements of benefits too, like life insurance and that kind of stuff too, that we would look at to find efficiencies and make recommendations as well.
But that part of your career did not last long. You pivoted into media sales. So tell us what media publishing is and how did you find the role?
So while I was working at Mannion Wilkins, I started a blog, which this was like before social media as we know it today existed. And it was my way of sort of escaping from like the corporate redundance, corporate just going into the office every day and seeing people who I felt weren't very fashionable or cool. And so I created a blog. I was in my Sex and the City era where I would see Carrie writing her column, you know, for Vogue every Saturday night with my girlfriends. And I was so inspired by like how cool her life was and her living in New York. And I wanted to just create something that spoke to those interests. So I created a blog called What Women Want, and it actually took off and did really well. And I had a lot of people visiting. I think it had like 30,000 page views a month or something like that, which was a lot at the time because most of those views were very hyper-local to the GTA. And I started selling ads on the blog and made some connections that way. And I sort of started to understand how to just how digital media worked. And from that I was able to parlay my understanding of digital media sales into getting a job in traditional media at Rogers Media. Well, that didn't happen actually right away. I started working at a company called Media Planet first, where they sold advertising sections into the National Post and the Toronto Star and the Metro. And I started working there and loved it. But it was also one of those jobs, it was kind of like the telemarketing where you're calling people, trying to get them to buy a page, an advertising page in this newspaper section. And then you'd have a lot of people hang up on you, but then you'd have people, you know, that would actually buy from you. So I learned everything that I know about cold calling and direct sales from that job at Media Planet. And then I was there for a year and got the job at Maclean's magazine under Rogers Media shortly right after that.
Can we point one thing out about your blog, What Women Want? You said 30,000 monthly page views, and we need to point out to anyone listening that this is back in 2005. There was no social media amplification. That traffic that you were getting, it sounds like people were bookmarking your page and going back daily, because that's the way pre-social media, a lot of us chose who to visit on a daily basis.
Yeah, that's how it worked. I think that there was, there was like a feed on Blogspot where you could like subscribe to different blogs and like it would show you different blogs.
Ah, gotcha. Yeah, the RSS feed. I know what you're talking about.
RSS feed, yes, where you would get served your different blog posts from your favorite blogs. So, but I did have like thousands of subscribers. And then I learned just like by Googling and things like that, how to optimize my titles and my blog posts for like SEO. So just like, so that I would get a lot of traffic from people searching different things. And I made sure also to, and again, this is pre-social media, I would make sure that I was posting about things that were relevant. So like if there was like, this was like in the era, like the Obama era. So like, I would post about like Michelle Obama's outfits, like on the campaign trail, and people would search like, what was Michelle Obama wearing? Or, you know, this was like in the very beginning with like Kim Kardashian and Paris Hilton, when they were like at the height of their, you know, I guess,
scandalous
times. I also worked at Holt Renfrew while I was in university. So I knew what all the brands were. So if I saw them wearing like a dress and I knew the brand, I would be like, hey, this is like where you can get Kim Kardashian's like outfit. Like I would post about stuff like that. And I, cause I knew intuitively that people would search for that. And as a result of that, I would get a lot of traffic on my site because I would preemptively know what people would be looking for. And I would try to post things around that. And I think that's just like how everyone does sites, like does blogs now and sets up their site and to optimize it for traffic. But that's what I was doing. I found that out sort of accidentally. I think after posting about something that Michelle Obama wore, like my views like blew up on my website. And I was like, oh my gosh, I need to start posting about stuff that's like timely and relevant that people are searching for now. And then I also, you know, there were certain things that I posted about like that over time did well. So that's why I understood the value of evergreen content to post about things that people are searching for all the time. So I kind of just like learned a lot of those things through trial and error and just sort of just the passion of like writing and connecting with people online.
We're going to take a quick break. Enjoying this episode? Of course you are, or you wouldn't have made it this far. Compliment your listening experience by subscribing to the Media People newsletter at mediapeople.ca/newsletter or at mediapeople.beehive.com. It's a mix of original and curated content designed to feed your curiosity while aiding in personal development. On top of more podcasts, we'll connect you with articles, interviews, and industry events. Subscribe at mediapeople.ca/newsletter or mediapeople.beehive.com.
How did the opportunity to join Rogers present itself? Did you apply? Did you get headhunted just through your network?
So Sean, who also worked at Rogers, so my husband, Sean, he had been working at Rogers for a few years and he had left Rogers to go and work at Rogers' competitor, Bell. And his old boss was like, I'm looking for somebody to join the McLean's team for the university ranking issue. Do you know of anybody? And he was like, I actually do know of somebody, like my girlfriend. She would be great for the job. So that's how I got my interview. And I met with Penny Hicks, who was heading up McLean's at the time. She was the ad director. And then my first interview went really well. And then I had my second interview with Lorraine Hoffler, who also really liked me. And I got the job and the rest is history.
What was it like stepping into Rogers compared to, say, Media Planet Publishing? Because I did do a bit of Googling on Media Planet and compared to Rogers. And as you know, we worked together for a bit when I was at Rogers. Rogers is a massive conglomerate compared to some of these smaller media companies where you have a little bit more room to maneuver, a little bit more flexibility. Was it a bit all-encompassing going, oh my God, there are so many things going on here that I have to keep up with, or I don't have the ability to be as flexible as I would at Media Planet? Like, was there a bit of like corporate culture shock?
So there was a bit of corporate culture shock, but not in the way that you might expect. So I had worked at major corporations before, because actually prior to working at Manion Wilkins, I worked at Manulife. And I had also had jobs like working at the bank and stuff like that as like a teller. So I knew what it was like working in the corporate world. But when I was at Media Planet, it was like all young people. And we were like, do you know Wolf of Wall Street? Were like picking up the phone and calling people and they're like, I got a sale. Or like you would do a shot after every time you like you sold something. Like that's what it was like at Media Planet.
That's awesome.
So like when I got to Rogers, I was hungry. I was like, I'm ready. I was like, where's the sales floor? Like, where are the phones? Like, where, like, people have their, like, they just sit in their cubicles and they're just like quiet. I remember when I closed my first deal, it was like a $20,000 ad in McLean's to the University of Toronto. I was like, woo, I got a sale. Like I stood up, I was like ready to celebrate. And like, people looked at me like, girl, like, are you okay? Is everything okay? Like everyone is just, you know, it's super quiet. People come and go and do their thing. But I really love that I started off at Media Planet, where everyone was hungry and people were like, they would, you know, make 100 phone calls a day, because it lit a fire up inside of me like no other. So going into Rogers and everyone was just super chill, just, you know, would do their thing. I was still doing that, like 100 calls a day, you know, 150 emails a day. And I, like, the territory I had was like, I think $1 million, and I turned it into like millions of dollars, like within like a very short period of time, because I was digging and finding, you know, new revenue streams everywhere I could look.
Your promotion to education specialist, did you put your hand up and say, hey, I want that when the opening presented itself? Or did, say, a manager come to you and go, look, Shanae, we're going to move you into this role?
Yeah, so I was actually hired as an education specialist, but being the education specialist in Elevate, that was like, I had established myself as like somebody who was a digger, who was just really great at outbound sales. So when we, I think it was Jack Tomic, when he came on board and sort of like, we reorganized things a bit, I was able to maintain that education specialist title, but then it was across all of our properties. So I could sell education on radio or in television or digital. I think that's actually how you and I ended up working together a little bit, because you and I both had York University, if I remember correctly.
You remember York? I could have sworn it was Queens.
Maybe it was Queens. You know what? It was Queens. It was one of the universities, because that's how I remember working with you. So that's how I, because I was like the education girl. So any college or university client, the thing is they had a lot of money. So I was assigned to all of them, regardless of what agency they were assigned to. And I was selling education ads everywhere, radio, television, digital, print, you name it.
Was it difficult to get them to expand the horizon? Because you mentioned when things had changed at Rogers, and I remember they used the term, it was one call, and you were selling everything because you were doing a lot of print and digital with your partners. And then all of a sudden, you've probably got someone saying to you, hey, Shanae, can you find a way to get U of T on City TV now, like broadcast, or get them on radio? Was that kind of an added challenge for you?
It was an added challenge, but it was something that I rose to the occasion, because I was always thinking of really cool ways that we could do stuff out of print. Because like this was in the era where the people that were the decision makers, they were buying print just because that's what everyone had done before. But it's like print readership was dropping drastically at that point. And kids going into university were definitely not reading print. But they were still buying print ads because, you know, that's kind of like the showpiece that you can go and you can show your boss, hey, I got us like an ad in the university rankings issue. But kids were getting all of their information online and digitally. So I was excited when we got to expand into different properties and different platforms, because I could come up with ideas and ways for them to reach that same audience, but just in a different medium.
Okay, so let's bring everything full circle, because Kensington Gray was the next step after your career at Rogers. And I got a lot of questions, and a lot of questions really focused on the foundation of Kensington Gray. So let's go really back to the beginning. When did you get this idea? Like, when did it come to you and go, I see an opportunity?
So what's funny is that the opportunity kind of like fell in my lap. I was kind of acting as like a pro bono talent manager to a lot of my friends who were influencers, as well as people within the industry, like influencers that knew me to be somebody who they could go to if they didn't know how to price something out. Because of what we did in, you know, traditional media, in my mind, an impression was an impression. Whether that impression was on television or whether it was in digital, in a, you know, magazine or on a radio station or on YouTube or Instagram, it was an impression. So I kind of used some of the pricing like methodologies that we used at Rogers to price out of different mediums and platforms. I applied that to social media. And that's when I applied that to social media, I realized first and foremost that a lot of my friends were undercharging substantially. And secondly, that there could be a huge opportunity for this. And so I started a Facebook group with my best friend, and we started advising influencers just for free, just like out of love. And we invited Black influencers in particular, because I felt like they were the influencers that were getting the shortest end of the stick for a number of reasons. I felt like there was a bias gap with the decision makers that were booking influencers for campaigns, they would often book people that looked like them or people that they already followed on social media. And if in a predominantly white industry, that results in predominantly white talent being casted for opportunities. So there was that bias resulting in very few Black influencers, if any, being casted for opportunities. But then in the rare situations where there was actual diversity on some of these influencer programs, the influencers lacked the knowledge to price themselves fairly, and they were underselling themselves tremendously. Like, I'm talking people charging $500 for something that they should be charging $25,000 for. It was wild. So I took it upon myself to educate people on the value that they were providing for these major media outlets. And one of the girls in the group was a writer for Forbes, and she saw all of the banter in the group and the wins that women were having because of the knowledge that was being shared in the group. And she's like, I want to write a story about this. Like, I think that what you guys are doing is like kind of like unprecedented and groundbreaking, and I'd like to write a story in Forbes. And we were like, of course. And so she did. And that article, I was still working at Rogers when that article came out, and the article went viral. And I resigned, I think like a week or so after that article came out, because a number of people were like, hey, can you manage me? Like, I really like, can you like, you seem to like really know what you're doing. Like, can you manage me? And at first I was like, no, I'm just doing this like for fun. But then after like the third or fourth person asked if I could manage them, I was like, you know what? I think I can do this. So I said yes. And those people that we signed back in 2019, that I started working with freelance, they're still signed to Kensington Grey to this day. So that is how Kensington Grey first started, and how we signed our first clients. And then I convinced Sean, who had just been laid off of his job at the time, and he was starting to look for jobs, and he had some like really big interviews. It was like TikTok Canada that was just launching in Canada at the time, and Facebook, and a number of other places like he was interviewing at. And I was like, hey, you have like severance like from your previous job for like 6 months. Let's like give this a go for like 3 months. Like, there's never going to be another time where you are not working, but you're going to still have an income. And we have a business opportunity here where we can like really like give it our all. And if we give it our all, like, this could really turn into something. And so he was in, and we've been in a profit making position since day one. Now, were we able to pay ourselves salaries and everything from day one? No, but we were profitable from day one. And then we were able, like really, really profitable, like after, I would say like 12 months in.
Where did the name Kensington Grey come from?
That's our daughter's name.
Oh, geez. It's named after your daughter.
Yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong, you were on maternity leave while the idea manifested.
Yes. Well, I was on maternity leave while the idea for the group, the Facebook group, manifested.
Oh, okay.
And then I was back. I came back to work. So I was back for like about a year before actually starting the company. And I started the company shortly after I left Rogers.
Do you remember the first time you discovered or heard of the term influencer or learned what an influencer was?
At some point, I want to say 2016, maybe 2015, the term changed from blogger to influencer. And I think it's because people were realizing that the profession wasn't defined by the platform. People were calling people bloggers because, you know, they blogged, but the profession should not be determined by the platform that they were sharing content or influencing people on. It was really the reverse. It was the actual action that they you know, should be defined or described by, which is, you know, they're people of influence, regardless of whether that's on a blog or if it's on Twitter or if it's on Instagram. There had been many social media platforms that had risen and fallen at that point. But the one thing that remained constant is that there were these influencers that flocked from platform to platform, whether it was MySpace to Twitter to, you know, Blogspot to Instagram to Facebook to whatever. The one thing that remained constant was that we were all influencers that influenced others.
You mentioned that you started the company back in 2019, and we're talking maybe about 6 or 8 months later, the pandemic hits. I mean, you're taking it well, you're laughing. So how I think it was like March 13th, 2020. And yeah. I kind of half jokingly blame the NBA. I always believed if the NBA did not shut down, that wouldn't have, like, there would have been no second domino. Like, it would have been, we would have found a way to get through this. But you're going into that weekend. The NBA says we're going on sabbatical, and one by one other, because let's face it, in North America, we follow sports. We don't follow anything else other than sports. If sports stops, we all stay home. And one by one, other leagues are putting their hands up and saying, you know what? We're going to hit the pause button too. You're going through that weekend. What are you and Sean talking about? Like, you guys are looking at each other going, okay, a lot of things are changing. We're both entrepreneurs right now. Our business is in its infancy. How did that change the shape and scope of Kensington Gray?
Yeah, we were about to hire our first employee. This was like in the beginning of March, like I want to say like March 1st or 2nd. And the first thing that we did was, okay, we're going to put a pause on hiring you. Sorry. and the craziest thing happened. She was like, I actually already submitted my notice at work. And we were like, oh my God, you did? Like, well, call them back and tell them that you still want to work there. And then she was like, no, like I put in my notice, like I'm working for Kensington Gray now. And I was just like, oh my God. So me and Sean were like, okay, this is what we can do. Because we hadn't even given her official offer yet, but like the interview went so well that she pretty much was like, I got this in the bag. So I forgot about this until this moment. We were like, okay, this is what we're going to do. We can hire you like hourly and pay you hourly. But like right now, like we can't bring you on as like a full-time employee yet. And she's like, okay, yeah, I'm cool with that. That's fine. And so Sean and I were having conversations like, oh my God, like, what do we do? Like, should we pack things up? Because the narrative at that time was that everyone was pausing campaigns. Okay, we're going to put this campaign on pause. The emails were always like, hey, I hope everyone is doing well and they're healthy. You're healthy and safe. But we're just going to put a pause on this campaign just due to world events right now. And so everything was being put on pause, but they weren't canceling. In fact, during the whole pandemic, we only had one campaign cancel because of the pandemic. And it was just because of like timing or something or logistics with like the inventory. But I would say maybe 3 or 4 weeks after everything shut down, I think the world realized that, hey, like this is the new normal. We better get used to it. So the campaigns were like, okay, we just want to like circle back with you to let you know the campaign's back on, but we've shifted the focus. We want you to shoot at home. We want you to wear loungewear instead of like workwear. We want you to, you know, basically realign the messaging to fit into this new normal of us quarantining, being at home, wearing masks, social distancing, and all of the things. And it worked. All of the campaigns that we had booked previously, they all executed. And then we started getting like quarantine style campaigns because all the photo studios were shut down. The agencies were shut down. Like everyone that would have been, and all the infrastructure needed to execute large scale media campaigns, that all shut down. Also, live sports was gone. So advertising dollars that would have gone to that was now being shifted to social media dollars because everyone was, they were drawn to their phones. That's where they were getting their news. That's where they were getting, you know, the updates on what was happening in the world. So it was back to being business as usual. And then several weeks after that, the tragedy with George Floyd happened. And that changed the trajectory of Kensington Gray permanently, forever.
You mentioned that changes the trajectory. Like, how did that impact the company?
Well, it was the Great Reckoning, where brands and corporations had to take a long and hard stare in the mirror and ask themselves whether they were truly operating their businesses in a way that was truly diverse and inclusive. And if not, what am I going to do to change that? And at the time, when asked, and this is in the influencer space, you know, are your influencer marketing campaigns diverse? Do you cast Black talent for opportunities? And for many of these people, the answer was no. A lot of them, you had to go back years to find them even post one Black person on their Instagram. Black people weren't even posted on people's Instagram pages. It was wild. And so all of a sudden, we were inundated with inquiries from brands asking to work with our influencers. And at the time, we were one of the only, if not the only, influencer management firm that focused on Black talent. So when brands were asking, where do we find Black creators, our name was mentioned and recommended as an agency that you could go to that represented Black creators. And we went from having that one employee that we weren't even sure if we could afford to having to hire 5 or 6 employees like in the next like 3 months. And then we've since tripled, quadrupled, like 10 times over, like in terms of size of like our team.
So you'd say the company looks vastly different from what it looked like on day one.
Yes. Yeah. On day one, it was Sean and I working around our kitchen table, managing a handful of influencers. And today we have a team of 40 plus employees in Canada, full-time employees in Canada and the US, and a roster of about 110 creators.
Sinead, this has been a wonderful chat. Are you ready for rapid fire questions?
Yeah.
Okay. The campaign you are most proud of.
I'm really proud of the work that we did with Revlon and the 15% pledge last month.
Your favorite movie?
You know, this is like weird, but a movie that's like etched in my brain is like Thelma and Louise. I can't believe they drove off the cliff together, but I thought it was like badass at the same time.
If Hollywood were to make a movie based on your life story, who would you want to play you?
I don't think we look anything alike, but I think that Kelly Rowland is having a moment right now, and I love that for her. So I will say Kelly Rowland.
My follow-up to that question, if Hollywood were to make this movie based on your life story, what would you call it?
Influence or something like that. The business of influence. I don't know. I'm the worst at answering those types of questions, but yeah, I would say maybe influence.
Your favorite book?
48 Laws of Power has served me well over the years.
Your favorite song?
That's a good one. I really like Texas Hold'em right now by Beyonce.
The best advice you have ever received?
Do not believe the good things that people tell you and the bad things that people tell you. Don't let that get to you, because neither one of them is as true as you think that they are.
My signature closing question, if you weren't in media, what would you be doing and why?
I'd be dead. Honestly, I wouldn't be doing anything else. I was born to do this.
Sinead, this has been a fantastic chat. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.